We are in Numbers chapter 29. It is lesson number 18. If I was a prophet, I would say we have two lessons left after this one. We may have three, but I believe we will have two, and we will be through with the book of Numbers and be going on to someplace else after that. In last week's lesson, Moses had been told by the Lord that he was to climb the mountain, go up to the top of the apex of a mountain, and there he would see the land that had been promised to Israel from the days that they had left, days of Abraham. But he would see what the goal was for when he took the nation of Israel outside of Egypt. But he would not go into that promised land, but he would be able to see it. And the Lord said, when you get up there on top of that mountain, you will go to join your fathers. In other words, he was going to die. But before he climbed the mountain, there were some things that the Lord wanted Moses to remind the people about. And so the Lord said to Moses, I want you to remind them about the daily offerings. I want you to remind them about the Sabbath offering. I want you to remind them about the monthly offering. And also there's that Feast of Unleavened Bread offering. I want you to remind them about those. And those are the ones we got through last week. And as we looked at those last week, there was a very unique thing that showed up that is very difficult to pick up until you chart out the scriptures. And you know, I'm always drawing you pictures and charting things out. And so there, the first chart that we see in your notes is that every time the Lord said, I want you to sacrifice a lamb for my offering, the lamb was always included a tenth of an ephah of flour, a quarter of a hin of beaten oil, and a quarter of a hin of wine to be placed on that lamb while it was cooking over on the altar. Every time there was a bull, there was 3/10 of a ephah of flour, fine flour, a quarter of a hin of beaten oil, a half a hin of wine, because, you know, that bull's a little bigger than that lamb. When a ram was to be offered, it required 2/10 of an ephah of flour, a quarter hin of beaten oil, and a third of a hin of wine. And then when the goat offering was made, which would be a sin offering, when that goat offering was made, it only required a half a hin of wine to go with it. And every time a lamb or a ram or a bull is mentioned in these offerings, the associated flour, the associated oil, the associated wine was always exactly to this menu, exactly to this recipe. It never varies. So in fact, by the time we get through the end of this chapter, the Lord is not having Moses say a tenth or 3/10 or whatever. The Lord has Moses just simply said, and with the accompanying flour, wine, or oil, because it's always the same. So what happens is we end up with a very easy menu or recipe to follow, no matter how many lambs or rams or bulls or whatever are being offered. You know you have this much flour, this much oil, and this much wine per bull, per lamb, per goat, whatever it is. So the Lord had told Moses, remind the people about the daily offering. One lamb is to be offered in the morning and one lamb is to be offered in the evening with its associated flour, oil, and wine every day. It does not matter what other offerings are occurring on that day, be it the Sabbath offering or the monthly offering or the Feast of Unleavened Bread offerings. A daily offering was to happen in the morning and the evening every day. Then when the Sabbath came along, that added to the mix. You have the daily morning, the daily evening, and a Sabbath offering, which would be two lambs that would be offered also. And then lo and behold, whenever that moon comes up, the new moon, the start of a new month, there was a monthly offering that was also required, and that was two bulls, one ram, and seven lambs. with the associated amount of flour, oil, and wine for each animal. So you just added it up. It actually becomes fairly easy. Same thing happens with the Feast of Unleavened Bread. There are two loaves of bread that are added to it, but the daily offering is two bulls, one ram, seven lambs, and of course a goat. It's the same thing as the monthly offering. So there's nothing really difficult about this. Now the menu changes just a little bit for different things, but there's only really two extra things you have to remember. Sometimes it's one bull and sometimes it's two bulls or something like that. And actually, as we will see when we get to it and we chart it out, it's actually very easy to remember. Furthermore, let's say on the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which has nothing to do with the Feast of Passover. Passover occurs on Nisan the 14th. That menu had to do with a lamb or a kid or a goat that was the size to feed whatever family you were feeding. There was bitter herbs, which means they had a salad to go along with it and other things. That was a prescription that is not in this instruction. Why? Because in this instruction, this is for when they go into the promised land. They have not been celebrating all of these offerings in the wilderness. Some of them they have, the morning and evening they have, the Sabbath they have, but not all of them have they been celebrating. But when they get into the promised land, the Lord wants to make sure they celebrate these feasts once they get there and get on the land of their inheritance. And so with the Feast of Fruits, First Fruits, we also talked about last week. Now, First Fruits is after they take in the crop. And remember I said to you, the way that is designed, there is no calendar date on that. For the daily offering, it's every day. It's on the calendar. For the Sabbath, it's every Sabbath, every seventh day of the week. It's on the calendar. For the new moon or the monthly offering, it's on the calendar. For the Feast of Passover, that happens on the 14th of the month. And the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which goes for 7 days, starts on the 15th of Nisan, of the first month of the year. That's on the calendar. But now we come to the Feast of Fruits. It's not on the calendar. The way it was determined was when the grains and everything was ripe in the field, they would go out and they'd put the sickle to the grain. They would cut it down and they would take it and they would put it into the storehouse. There would be the next Sabbath day after the grain, the week the grain is in the storehouse, they would go through the Sabbath, and then on the first day of the week, the Sunday after the Sabbath, just for instance, yesterday was the Sabbath, let's say we got our grain into the barns last Thursday. On Saturday, we had our regular Sabbath, and today is Sunday. So today, we would begin our Feast of First Fruits, and we would have our first offering today because this is the day, and it would be a wave offering. We would take into the priest, or the priest would take a sample of the grain, and he would wave it before the Lord, and in doing so, he would also offer up seven lambs, two bulls, he would offer one lamb, one bull, two rams, and one goat, and two loaves of bread that had leaven in them. They were leavened bread. They had yeast in them. They were not unleavened bread because unleavened was for the Passover. And this is for first fruit. This is about bringing in the grain. These two loaves of bread that were offered on that first Sunday after the Saturday were to be leavened. Then you would count off the 50 days, which included the Sunday, and lo and behold, 50 days later, you had what is called the Feast of Pentecost. It's the 50th day, the Pentecost, the 50 meaning the Penta, dealing with the 50, and it would culminate that 50-day celebration. With that, you went back to the regular form, the same number of animals as the Feast of Unleavened Bread. It'd be seven lambs, two bulls, one ram, and one goat. So our chart is beginning to lay out. It becomes fairly easy to remember. Well, with today we pick up, that we did not have time to finish last week, we pick up with chapter 29, verse 1, on the first day of the seventh month, Well, let me explain that to you. And I think I need to draw a chart on the board to make it look easier. Okay, let's just do this. Here is month one, and here is month seven. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. The instruction to Moses from the Lord was, go to the seventh month of the year on the very first day, and I want you to have this special feast. Now, here's the reason I wrote this up here. This seventh month, every place else in the world, every place else in the world is the first month of the year. Got that? This actually is the first month of the year. It is going to become the month that we know as Tishri. All right? That's what the Jews call it. Actually, that's what the Babylonians called it. The Jews do not have names for their months until they come back from the Babylonian exile. When Cyrus the Great lets them go, they're not even in control of their land. They've already lived on their land. They've already taken the land, which they haven't even done yet in our story in Numbers. They've lived on it. They've had Saul as king. They've had David as king. They've had Solomon as king. And then the whole thing splits apart. And then lo and behold, they're exiled from the land, and they're gone for 70 years. And finally, Cyrus the Great lets them come back. And when they come back from exile, they bring names back with their months. So it is a long time before they're going to call it Tishri. But right now, they're calling it the seventh month of the year. But everybody else is calling it the first month. And I will explain that to you in a minute. How is this not the first month on the Jewish calendar? If you remember, when they came out of Egypt, they came out in the month that we are going to know later on, same time they picked the name Tishri, they call it Nisan. On Nisan the 14th of the month, on the 14th, was the Passover. On the 15th of the month, they left Egypt and headed out towards the wilderness. And the Lord said to them, I believe it was on the third day that they were out, I want you to make this the first month of your calendar year. You remember that? And so he switches it. The rest of the world still thinks Tishri is the first month. But now Nisan is the first month for the Jews. So there's a six-month offset in the Jewish calendar and the calendar of the world. Everybody else is still on the calendar. This is the first month, but it's not. It's the seventh month on the Jewish calendar. So we know that that is Tishri. Now, what is very interesting about that is that the Lord picks that because it is a special day in history. Let's find out what that day is. Verse 1 says, now in the seventh month, on the first day of the month, you shall also have a holy convocation, a calling together to worship the Lord. You shall do no laborious work on that day. It will be to you a day for blowing trumpets. We call it the beginning of the Feast of Trumpets, and that's the reason why. You're going to blow these trumpets. You shall offer a burnt offering of a soothing aroma to the Lord, one bull, one ram, seven male lambs, 1 year old without defect. Also their grain offering, fine flour mixed with oil, 3/10 of an ephah for each bull, 2/10 for the ram, and 1/10 for the seven lambs. That's the same recipe that we've had up above. Nothing's changed. Offer one male goat for a sin offering to make atonement for you. By the way, that is an instruction to the priest. When the priest is making this, okay, when the priest is giving the bulls and giving the offering of the lambs and offering of the ram, that's for the people. But for the priest, just in case he's sinful, he gets the goat. The goat is for his sins. Besides the burnt offerings and the new moons and its grain offering and the continual burnt offering of its grain offerings and their drink offerings. In other words, whenever this falls, when this falls on this first day of the month, I want you to do this first day of the seventh month. I want you to do these offerings along with the monthly offering, along with the daily offering, and along with the Sabbath offering. And you do this here because this is a special day, a day for blowing the trumpets. Now, I want you to look down at the chart on the next page, the first chart on the next page, and you'll see I have the days of creation listed there. First day of creation has no date. Second day of creation has no date. Third day of creation, no date. Fourth, no date. Fifth, no date. Sixth, no date. Seventh day. What did the Lord do on the seventh day of creation? He rested from his work because creation was finished on the sixth day. There is not a Jewish scholar out there. There is not a Jewish writer out there that you will ever find that ever believes or ever dates on a calendar the 6 days of creation. No one starts the dating of a calendar on day one of creation. They all start it on day seven when the Lord rested from creation. In other words, the first day on every calendar that has ever been created that tries to go back to the time of creation always begins on the seventh day, on the Sabbath day. The most important day of the week in the Jewish Israel life is the Sabbath day, and it begins with Tishri 1 of year 1. You follow me? Because that was the first month of the first year and the very first date on that calendar. The Lord, with the children in the wilderness, changes that and moves it ahead, skips it ahead 6 months. So there's a skip. Jewish life skips 6 months in the calendar, but there's no place else in the world that they skip the calendar like that. In fact, at the time of the Exodus, there is absolutely no country in the world that is on a calendar different from the calendar that they were on before the Exodus. All the world is on a lunar calendar. All the world, a year is 354 days. All the world has 12 months in a year. The first, all the odd months, like we'd call it January, March, all the odd months, 1, 3, 5, all have 30 days, and all the even months, like February and on, have 29 days. And so the cycle is perfect that way. 30, 29, and so on. Every nation in the world also recognized that the world was created in 6 days and that God rested on the Sabbath. However, by the time that they are in the wilderness, there is a great discussion about who the God was that did the creation. In other words, no one rejected that it was created in 6 days. The question was, what was the name of God and how did God want to be worshiped and who were they worshiping? Of which we already know that many of them were worshiping Baal. We know that many of them in different areas were worshiping Chemosh and Molech, all names for the same God, just with different cultures. Over in Greece, they're worshiping a god by the name of Zeus. Romans are Jupiter, and the whole nine yards with that, which are the exact same gods, were just with different names depending on the language of the people. And by the way, they also worshiped him differently in the different places. In fact, the worship of Baal was just flat, ungodly, intolerable, and terribly, terribly sinful and evil. And we know that because, remember, we had the story of Balaam and his donkey and what they were worshiping and how they worshiped. It's just evil. Now, well, also, I told you that in lesson 17, we'd get to what happened to Balaam and to Baal. And we didn't make it there. I thought it was going to be in last week's lesson. And I was hoping it'd be in this week's lesson, but we're not going to get to it either. But it is in the first part of next week's lesson. So we're already, it will be in lesson 20 instead of lesson 17. So by the time of the Exodus, and by the time we see this, we've got this stuff going on with all of these offerings. And look down at how it makes our combined chart look. I mean, we have a lot of animals here that are being sacrificed. A lot of animals. So we've just now added the Feast of Trumpets, which in the mindset of God was the first day on the calendar of the world, Tishri the first. It's a celebration of that very first day on the first calendar whenever the Lord rested from his creation. Verse 7 says, then on the 10th day of this seventh month, you shall have a holy convocation, and you shall humble yourself, and you shall do no work. And it goes on to say you're going to give one bull, one ram, seven lambs. Same menu, same everything as before. So you'll see that this chart starts to form, of which it really wasn't difficult to follow. Now, what was the 10th day of the month of this seventh month on the Jewish calendar, but it's the first month for everyone else? That is, the 10th is called the Day of Atonement. It is recorded to be, according to the Lord, here a special day. It is the day of which the atonement of the original sin was made by the Lord. In other words, on the 10th day of the first month was the day that the Lord said to Adam and Eve, that little giddy-up that y'all have sewn together of fig leaves is not adequate to cover what you have done. What you have done can only be covered by the shedding of blood. And the Lord took a bull and shed his blood for the sins and remissions of Adam and Eve. And he took the skins and hides and made for them a covering to cover their bodies, because lo and behold, when they had taken and eaten of that fruit, they looked down and realized for the first time that they were uncovered. Boy, y'all just chimed in on that one. I like the one over here. Different. Yes. Adam and Eve were different. Yes. And nothing has changed since. We're still different. Always different. And so they looked down and realized that they were different, and they began to hide their different parts. Now, I wonder what possessed them to think that those parts needed to be hidden. And I can tell you the answer to that as sure as I am standing here. I will tell you the reason why they thought and what they were thinking. And here's where you're going to find your answer. When you get to heaven, you'll know. Because we don't know. And lo and behold, it's been a problem ever since. I don't know if you've noticed that or not. Yes, ma'am. Why did they pick the figs? Yeah. I don't know if they were using the top side or the fuzzy side. I believe that fig trees on the fuzzy side are the original Velcro, by the way. You just, mercy. Anyway. So that's a traditional. Believe me, folks, it didn't happen just 3 days after. They did not eat that fruit 3 days after they were created. No, it was probably the way the timing works and everything according to the Lord's timing, which we started off when we did the book of Genesis. It probably took about 100 years before they actually reached up and grabbed that fruit and said, "Ooh, ooh, yes, sir." No. You have to remember something here. The question was, had it been like it been today, and Adam knew that he had to confess, and so when the Lord said, Adam, where are you? As if the Lord didn't know where he was. Okay? And Adam and Eve tried to hide. If he had confessed, would it have been different today? And the answer is no. And here's the reason why. We find in 1 Peter that before anything was created, God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit decided they would be three persons who show themselves as one God to the people, but in three persons, and they designed the whole thing because they wanted a people who would choose them to worship them, and all of their creation that would not choose them would also have a place away from them. That was all decided. It was all part of God's plan for that sin to happen. If it had not been, he would not have forbidden them of that one tree in the garden. It would not have been that way. But the Lord knew what he was doing, and he wanted it just for your edification and for your benefit. It's yours. Just for you. No one else but you. It doesn't matter about anybody else but you. Until I'm talking to him, and then it matters just to him, and nobody, see, it's all for every one of us, is what I'm trying to say. God knew his plan, and he wanted a people who would worship him and would choose him to be their God. And so he put within them the ability to make a choice to choose him or not to choose him. And everyone makes their choice. And there's been a whole bunch of people who've made the choice not to choose him. And that's what's so sad. Well, anyway, Tishri the 10th is the Day of Atonement. Then it says on verse 12, there's an appointed time for the 15th day of the month. Tishri has three holidays inside of it. 3 days off for the Jews of today, at least, but they also get the week off here. It's this week here. It's the 15th day of the month. You shall have a holy convocation. You shall do no laborious work, and you shall observe the feast of the Lord for 7 days. Now I'm going to read the first one to you, verse 13. It starts on the 15th of Tishri. You shall present a burnt offering, an offering by fire of a soothing aroma to the Lord, 13 bulls, 2 rams, 14 male lambs, 1 year old, which are without defect. Now, by the way, in this day, they had no concept of zero. No concept of zero. When it says 1 year old without defect, it actually means they have not reached the age of 1 year, 1 day. They are 1 year old or younger. With our kids, remember we have our baby. How old is that little baby? Oh, she's 3 months. They didn't count anything that way. How old? Oh, 9 months and 4 days. How mothers keep up with that, I don't know. How old is it? 11 months and 21 days. She'll be a year in just a few days. Well, when you reach the year plus 1 day, you're too old as a lamb to be offered. Got it? So it meant anything from a newborn up to 1 year, 1 day on the way we talk. No zeros in their counting. And you go on and mix them. Well, I've got these days charted out because it's the same thing over and over except for one, the number of animals for one animal changes. So looky there. Day one, see the chart? Look at bulls. 13 bulls. Go down to the chart on day two. The only thing that changes is 12 bulls. 13 goes to 12. On day three, the bulls goes to 11. Everything else is the same. Day 4 goes to 10. Day 5 to 9. Day 6 to 8. Day 7 to 7. We just got through 30 verses real quick. And I told you everything that's there. With the prescription, with the drink offering, with the flour, with it, because we've covered that. It's always the same recipe for the animal, no matter how many animals there are. It's the same amount for each animal. But then on the eighth day, in other words, after the 7 day feast is over, trumpet feast is over here. After the 7 day, I'm sorry, this is not trumpets, this is Sukkot. After the 7 day Sukkot feast is over, then there's an eighth day celebration then. And lo and behold, on that eighth day, it returns back to 7 lambs, 1 bull, 1 ram, and 1 goat, which is exactly the same offering as the Day of Atonement, which is exactly the same offering as the first, as the Feast of the First Fruits. Yes, sir. You got your hand up? You don't have your hand up? Oh, no. Sorry. Good. He had his hand up on holding it on the piano thinking, oh my, is he going to keep doing this? Do what? I wasn't getting deep. I was getting through it as quick as possible. Verse 39. We've got all these offerings. And then the Lord says, He says, Moses, I want you to talk to them. I want these people to present these offerings, but then I want you to talk to them about something else. So it's verse 29, 39, he says, you shall present these to the Lord at your appointed times. So in other words, all these offerings have to occur at the right times. They're required. And then the Lord goes on to say to Moses, tell him this, besides what? Besides your votive offerings, your free will offerings, your burnt offerings, and your grain offerings, and your drink offerings, and your peace offerings. So Moses spoke to the sons of Israel in accordance with all that the Lord had commanded Moses. Now let me explain here what we're talking about. All these offerings with 14 bulls and 12 bulls and 11 bulls and 13 bulls and 14 lambs and 7 lambs and 1 goat and 1 goat and 1 ram and 2 ram and all that, with all this flour and all this oil, where did they get all that? Because it's not happening across the whole nation. It is one offering of 7 lambs, 1 bull, 1 ram, 1 goat, or whatever the prescription is, for the entire nation of Israel. And the priest is going out and selecting those animals from the backlog of animals that have been brought to the tabernacle, later on to the synagogues, and later on to the temple, to the places that God chooses to have his worship occurred, wherever a person can bring an offering, this backlog of animals begins to occur. And what happens is the priest will go out to the herd of lambs, to the herd of rams, to the herd of bulls, and they will select the best 10% of the animals that have been brought for other offerings, such as these 6 that we just mentioned. And I'll explain that in a minute. And they'll select the best 10%, and from that they'll select the lamb for the morning or the lamb for the night or whatever. And the other 90% of the animals that are there will be parceled out to the Levites, who are not allowed to own cattle. They are not allowed to own land. They are not allowed to herd. The Levites are to eat and to survive as families from these free will votive offerings of the people that are brought to the places of worship. In other words, for being a Levite, they got a paycheck of an animal here, an animal there, and all that to eat off, and they had to eat regularly. And so what occurred in all these mass offerings that you see, be it daily, monthly, weekly, or whatever, those were taken from the offerings that came in from the people who are making personal offerings. All the offerings that we have discussed this week and last week so far were offerings for the nation done by the priest. But now the Lord says this is these offerings were done besides the votive offering, besides the free will offering, besides your personal burnt offering, your grain offering. And so we have to ask the question, what are these offerings? Well, first of all, we have this votive offering. The word votive means a vow. Moses is about to speak about vows in chapter 30. And when we get there, we're going to see that they're extremely important, both for men and women who make these vows. We're not there yet. And it's important to understand that when a person made a vow to someone, let's say I came up to some man in this church, in this room, and said, I promise you that I'm going to do this for you. And as a proof, as collateral for my promise to you, I'm going to take this 5-month-old little lamb and I'm going to go offer him as an offering at the temple. It is not a requirement that every time I make a vow or a pledge or an offering that I go make a down payment at the temple. That's not required. But if I want to show to the person that I'm speaking to, I am swearing to God that I am going to do this for you, no matter whether it's good or whether it's bad, I'm going to do it, then I would go make an offering. And that person could count on it because he has sworn to God. He has sworn to God that he is going to do it. It is a voluntary thing. It is a votive. It is a voluntary offering. Now, in fact, the word votive doesn't even show up to the 1500s in the English language. It comes from a Latin word, and it means a gift. It means a gift that is given in the fulfillment of a promise. It doesn't mean that you're giving that gift to the one you're promising. It means that you're giving it to the Lord to say, I am going to do this. Now, in order for us to understand a little bit about the votive offering and also oaths, we have to go over into Deuteronomy 12. Now, I want to remind you of something before we look at Deuteronomy 12, verse 5. We're here in chapter 29 in the book of Numbers. We're going to have 35 chapters in the book of Numbers. When it's all said and done with the book of Numbers, Moses ends the book of Numbers very abruptly. Boom. Moses has been given this instruction from the Lord to do this, and let me tell you something. He still has a book called Deuteronomy to write. And we know that Deuteronomy is written in the last 30 days of Moses' life. And the book of Deuteronomy is going to pick up, and Moses is going to recap the history, and then he's going to retell a second telling of the major laws, again, that the people are supposed to remember. And then Moses is going to die in the book of Deuteronomy, and Joshua is going to pick up the pen, and he's going to finish the book of Deuteronomy for Moses. Well, Moses is coming to the point here in Numbers where he is kind of, I've got to tell you this, it's inspired by the Holy Spirit, I know that, but it's really fast-tracking us to the book of Deuteronomy. We are moving on just boom, 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 the last little Moses finishing up what he needs to tell all the people and what he needs to do. In fact, he's got to go into battle one more time. Moses is not done being the leader. He is going to lead them in battle one more time. And they're going to win. And then he's going to go up on the mountain. He's going to die after he's worked on Deuteronomy. That's all going to happen in the next 30 to 45 days from the time of this writing. We get over in Deuteronomy. This is going to be written within just a few days. And Moses is going to say this in Deuteronomy 12, verse 5. But you shall seek. Now, I'm pausing there because you see all that is in italics. I should have marked that out because that is not in the oldest and most original manuscripts that we have. That is in italics because it is someplace else in the scripture. In fact, it's at the bottom of this passage. So some well-meaning preacher took it from the bottom and wrote it up at the top with a little few extra words. And when the majority of the text got copied after 400 AD, it got put into the text. But it's here. We're going to skip it. So it says, verse 5, but you shall seek, and there you shall bring your burnt offerings, your sacrifices, your tithes, the contributions of your hand, your votive offerings, your freewill offerings, and the firstborn of your herd and of your flock. There also you and your household shall eat before the Lord your God and rejoice in all your undertakings in which the Lord your God has blessed you. You shall not do as what we are doing here today, every man doing what is right in his own eyes. In other words, Moses is going to have to yank in the chain and saying, things have to change. You can't just do what you want to do, what you think is right. You've got to do what is according to the law that the Lord has given you. So that's got to change. Verse 9 says, for you have not as yet come into the resting place and the inheritance which the Lord your God is giving you. Talking about the promised land. When you cross the Jordan and live in the land which the Lord your God is giving you to inherit, and he gives you rest from all your enemies around you so that you live in security, then it shall come about that the place, this is what we pick up from up above, in which the Lord your God shall choose for his name to dwell, there you shall bring all that I command you, your burnt offerings and your sacrifices, your tithes and your contributions of your hand, and all your choice votive offerings which you will vow to the Lord. Now what he's telling us now is, the way things are right now, we've got this tabernacle complex and we're all camped around it. But when we get into the promised land, or when you get into the promised land, it's not going to be like that anymore because you're going to be too far away to bring your offerings to the tabernacle. So the Lord is going to set up places where he says he is going to reside. sanctuary cities. By the way, that is where that term comes from. It's the place where the synagogues are, and they're all going to be close enough that whether you're living in the north of the promised land or in the south of the promised land, there is a place, a synagogue, for you to go and make your offering. And also, there's going to be Levites living and priests living all throughout that land also, wherever those sanctuaries are. So when you come, you can give your offering to the Levite. The Levite will take it from your hands. He'll put it into the pile with a pin. And he will offer it as a priest will come and do the offering in the different places. So many cities on one side of the Jordan, so many cities on the other side of the Jordan. So many cities to the north, so many cities to the south. These cities are there where you can take. It's just like for those of you who might live over on the northeast side of town, you want to take your offering to First Baptist Houston. Here on the south side of town, you bring it to Sagemont. If you go over to Baytown, take it over to Memorial or Cedar Bayou or Second Baptist. Choose which one you want. In other words, there's a location close to you to where you can take your offerings, and you don't have to make that long trip to wherever the tabernacle is going to be set up. You don't have to make that long trip. You take it to where it needs to go. And so here we see these special offerings, these tithes, these offerings that are happening. The one after the votive offering, the vow offering, is the free will offering. We just heard about that in Deuteronomy chapter 12 also. And a free will offering, where a votive offering was given because you wanted to make a promise. You gave the offering on your own. You're the one who thought it up. And because you thought it up, you're responsible for it. It's extremely important. You made the vow to God. He didn't ask for it. You better keep it. Now, there's a danger in that because we don't always do things right, and we don't always have our noggin screwed on right. Sometimes we make silly, foolish vows. Then there's free will offerings. Free will offerings are for whenever you are stirred by the impulse of your heart to give for some reason. For instance, 40 years before, or 38 years before, I should say, whenever the Lord wanted them to build the tabernacle complex. Moses came out, and boy, I wish I'd have heard that sermon. Whatever that sermon was, it caused people just to start giving. They gave gold, they gave silver, they gave this, they gave that. I mean, just away it went, and all this stuff came in. Finally, the craftsman had to come back to Moses and say, Moses, you got to slow this down. We got so much stuff, we're not going to be able to use it all. We're going to have gold left over, silver left over. So Moses had to bring it to an end. That's a free will offering. You give it because you've been moved in your heart. The perfect example of that comes from Exodus 35, verse 21 says, and everyone whose heart stirred him and everyone whose spirit moved him came and brought the Lord's contribution for the work of the tent of meeting, that's the tabernacle complex, and for all its services and all its holy garments. They brought thread, they brought material, they brought gold, they brought silver, they brought bronze, they brought wood, they brought everything they needed for that. Well, for a free will offering, here in this Feast of Weeks we're talking about, Deuteronomy 16 says, then you shall celebrate this Feast of Weeks to the Lord your God with a tribute of a free will offering of your hand, which you shall give just as the Lord your God blesses you. In other words, you've been blessed. You want to give a thanksgiving, free, wonderful offering to the Lord. And you'll do that and take it. And what happens is everybody's bringing thank offerings. Everybody's having kids. Because they have a child, they have to redeem that child. Now, you don't take that child in to be sacrificed. You take an animal for that child once you have the mother has the first boy son. You take and you redeem that child with a price of an animal of such. The first time that a mother lamb has a little lamb, that first lamb is taken to be offered in the temple and given to the temple or to the tabernacle or to the synagogue. The same thing with the ram, the bull, the sheep, the goat, everything. The first of the first is given. Also, whenever a person, let's say the patriarch of the family has died, but grandma's still alive, wife is still alive, and the oldest son becomes the new patriarch, and when he inherits, according to, we'd get over in Deuteronomy, according when he inherits it, he gives an offering, and he redeems all of it by taking the appropriate offerings, which could be very great and large in number, for what he just inherited. And he has to give a redemption for every human. Grandma, the mother of his father, or maybe the mother of his mother, who's still alive, but dad is dead, his mother, and all the workers who are in the care, plus all the babies of the workers who are in the care, all the way down to the newborns, who whatever human is alive under his care, he has to redeem them when he inherits them from his father. He also has to give a tithe and an offering off of all the animals. For every 10 that he has to give one, and it has to be the unblemished one, the perfect one, by the way. So just spin that out. If he's got 100, he's got to give 10. If he's got 1,000, he's got to give 100. So these animals for these free personal offerings are just pouring into the temple for all those nation offerings to be done at the appropriate time, the one in the morning, the one in the night, the one on the Sabbath, and all of that. Well, so in comes the grain, in comes the oil, in comes the wine, and then there's the peace offering, and that's the thanks offering. When the Lord just really blesses you, and you just want to say, thank you, Lord, you turn around and you say, Lord, this is not required, but I just want to give you a blessing. I just want to get you a blessing. So that happens. That's where that backlog of animals come from. And when you've got, think of it, 601,730 men who can handle a sword and go into war, and they've all got families. That's a lot of people, folks. That's a whole bunch of people. Chapter 30, verse 1 picks up with this. Then Moses spoke to the head of the tribes of the sons of Israel, saying, this is the word which the Lord has commanded. Moses is getting all this, and he's delivering it. He's just found out he's fixing to die. Remember that. So he's delivering the messages. And he says, if a man makes a vow to the Lord or takes an oath to bind himself with a binding obligation, he shall not violate his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds from his mouth. Well, we've already learned the difference, but what is the difference between a vow and an oath? The vow is a gift to the Lord for something you promised to do. An oath is when you make a solemn appeal to God, when you say, and you take the name of the Lord upon you is what you do. You say, I promise God, so help me God. You make this a binding obligation that you are going to tell the truth and you're going to fulfill your promise. What it is, no matter what it is, you're going to do it, so help you God. That means that you have taken the name of the Lord upon you, and you will fulfill your oath to the Lord. You have to be careful when you, from your side, make an oath to God, because a frivolous and a flippant vow to God can be extremely dangerous. The key to that, the classic example is that, is found over in Judges chapter 11. We're hundreds of years down from the time we are in the story here. Hundreds of years down, really. Probably almost 300 or a little bit less than 300. And we meet a man by the name of Jephthah. And he was born, when he was born, his mother decided that she would begin playing the harlot. And she began having sons and children with other men, not Jephthah's father. And as the boys grew up and they all grew up together, began to hate Jephthah, and they made him leave the family. And they lived together in the area of the Reubenite tribe. Along the way, Jephthah becomes a part of a group of hooligans, I'll just put it that way. And he's robbing and he's stealing, and he's quite adept at battle and war and all of that and fighting. And his brothers get in trouble because, you see, the Ammonites, the descendants of Lot, want to take their land back. And their land has been given to Reuben. And if you remember, the land was given to Reuben because Moses and the Israelites just destroyed the Amorite king Sihon. We studied about him, who had taken the land from the Amorites. Ammon being one of the grandsons of sons of Lot. And the Amorites were Canaanites. And lo and behold, Moses went through. They crossed the Arnon River and they started to fight in the war. And they won. They beat them. And they went on north of the Jabbok River and beat the king of Og and all his. And went all the way up to Mount Hermon and came down. Controlled the whole east side of the Jordan River. But lo and behold, these Ammonites decide after 300 years, they want their land back. Well, the Reubenites don't think that they can defeat them. And they need a leader. They need a leader bad. And so they think, well, you know, our brother, our half-brother, he's pretty good leader, and they're pretty good at fighting and winning, so let's go ask him if he will help us fight and win. So they go to him, and they say, Jephthah, would you come and fight with us, our brother? And he says, I tell you what, I'll come and fight with you, but if I win, and if we win, I want you to make me the chief of the tribe. I'm going to be the chief, the head of the Reubenites. I want that whole land. And I want to be all over all the people. And they said, okay, it's a deal. So they come in, and lo and behold, he takes them. He takes all his hooligans with him. And they fight the Amorites in this area of Reuben. And they win. That area should belong to the Ammonites. It was originally the Ammonites. But the Amorites took it from them. And the Israelites took it from the Amorites. King Zion, they destroyed him right there and killed him. Lo and behold, Reuben controls that land. We pick up in Judges chapter 11, verse 30, it says, and Jephthah made a vow before he went to battle, made a vow to the Lord and said, if thou wilt indeed give the sons of Ammon into my hand, then it shall be that whatever comes out of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the sons of Ammon, it shall be the Lord's, and I will offer it up as a burnt offering. So Jephthah crossed over to the sons of Ammon to fight against them, and the Lord gave them into his hands, and he struck them with a very great slaughter from Aor to the entrance of Minnith, 20 cities, and as far as Abel Kithmin. So the sons of Ammon were subdued before the sons of Israel. Then Jephthah came to his house at Mizpah. Behold, his daughter was coming out to meet him with tambourines and with dancing. Now she was his one only child. Besides her, he had neither son nor daughter. And it came about when he saw her that he tore his clothes and said, alas, my daughter, you have brought me very low, and you are among those who trouble me, for I have given my word to the Lord, and I cannot take it back. The daughter, being an upright daughter, says, Father, you've made your vow. You have to keep it. Please do this for me. Allow me to have a few days with some of my friends, my maids, and whatever, and then I will come back and I will give myself to you, and you can offer me up as the burnt offering. And that tragedy takes place. Because when you make a vow and you take the name of the Lord upon you, you must keep that vow. Therefore, the Lord said in the Ten Commandments, do not take the name of the Lord upon you in vain. That's the correct translation of that. I know y'all think that means don't cuss. But that's not what it means. It means do not take the name of the Lord upon you without understanding the consequences of doing that. Because if you make a vow to the Lord, he expects you to keep it. Don't do it with emptiness. Don't do it flippantly. Do it with purpose. When you say, God, I will accept this and I promise to do this, you better mean it. Well, with that, the Lord moves on into the vows of a woman. And it says in verse 3, also if a woman makes a vow to the Lord and binds herself by an obligation to her father's house in her youth, that means she makes a binding obligation by making a votive, an offering to the Lord, and her father hears her vow and her obligation by which she has bound herself, and the father says nothing to her, then all her vows shall stand, and every obligation by which she has bound herself shall stand. So if you're a young girl, a maid in the house, you got a father, you say you want to do something, you make a vow to the Lord, and the father hears about it, and he says nothing to you, it shall stand. Now, I got news for you. As I look around today, at our young folks, most of them don't have enough sense to know whether the vow they're making is a good vow or a bad vow. And most of us older folks just simply say this, oh, they'll grow out of it. You know what I'm talking about. We'll say, oh, that's just a wild hair. They'll grow out of it when they get older. Well, that's not the way it was to be back in these days. If the father heard about that, the father was supposed to do it. If he didn't do anything, that child, that girl, was responsible for her decision. Verse 5 says, but if her father should forbid her on the day he hears of it. In other words, he's got to move fast. He hears, he says, you're not going to do that. Not going to do it. None of her vows or her obligations by which she has bound herself shall stand. In other words, daddy can bring you to an end to it right then that day. And the Lord will forgive her because her father had forbidden her. In other words, daddy has authority. Verse 6 says, however, if she should marry while under her vow, and she, in other words, she makes this vow and daddy didn't say anything about it, and she's under that vow, it's a rash statement that came from her lips, which she has bound herself, and her husband hears of it. See, it's transferred from daddy now over to her new husband. And her husband says nothing to her on the day he hears it. Then her vow shall stand, and her obligation by which she has bound herself shall stand. But if on the day that her husband hears it, let's say they've been married for a week, and she says, oh, by the way, husband, I want to tell you, I made this vow 14 years ago, and I'm going to keep it. And he looks at her, and he says, on the day he hears it, he says, you are not. But if on the day, verse 8, if on the day her husband hears of it, he forbids her, then he shall annul her vow, which she is under, and the rash statement of her lips by which she has bound herself, and the Lord will forgive her. Mercy. You see it? In other words, women have authority over them, and their husbands have the authority to say, yeah, that's okay, you can keep that vow, or no, you can't. I forbid you to keep it. Now, I don't know about you, but I know how some of you women think today. Like a 5-year-old daughter of Robert Cupps and Betty Cupps back at one of my churches. She had gotten into she's 5 years old, and she'd gotten into these scissors of her mother's sewing, and she was sitting in front of the mirror cutting her own hair. And she realized that she was not doing a good job. She went out to her daddy and handed him the scissors and said to daddy, you should have been watching me. She really did. Megan is her name. You should have been watching me. And daddy said, well, honey, you should have been watching me, daddy. Look at this mess. Now, women, you could say to your husbands, you know, I told you about this thing about 6 months ago and you didn't get me off the hook. You should have gotten me off the hook. You should have been watching me. You should have got me off the hook. Yeah. Women have that availability in the Jewish life where the husband can disavow the vow. However, if you're widowed or you're divorced, look here, verse 9. But the vow of the widow or the divorced woman, everything by which she has bound herself shall stand against her. Surely by the time you're widowed or divorced, you have learned your lesson. You know, keep your mouth shut. Some things you don't need to tell God, and for hopefully you will not take upon the Lord's name upon you that you're going to vow and make an oath for something that you can't do. But if you do, you're bound by it. Verse 10 says, however, this is where we get into the authority. He's picking up from before. However, if she vowed in her husband's house or bound herself by an obligation with an oath, that means she made an offering, and her husband heard it but said nothing to her and did not forbid her, then all her vows shall stand, and every obligation by which she's bound herself shall stand. But if her husband indeed annuls them on the day that he hears them, then whatever proceeds out of her lips concerning her vows and concerning the obligations of herself shall not stand. Her husband has annulled them, and the Lord will forgive her. Every vow and every binding oath to humble herself, her husband may confirm it or her husband may annul it. But if her husband indeed says nothing to her from day to day when he confirms her vows or all her obligations which are on her, he has confirmed them because he has said nothing to her on the day he heard them. In other words, if he hears it, he can confirm it by saying you're not going to happen. Or if he hears it, he can confirm it by saying nothing and it's going to happen. But if he indeed annuls them after he has heard them, he shall bear her guilt. In other words, he can say no. And if he should have said yes or said nothing, then he is the one that is guilty. Men, we're still in today, in God's eyes, we're still responsible for the families, and we're still responsible for the things that are said. Verse 16 says, these are the statutes which the Lord commanded Moses as between a man and his wife, and as between a father and his daughter, while she is in her youth in her father's house. In other words, men were to be responsible for what was said as well as what was done by the women and the daughters in the family. Never was a woman in such a position in the Bible. Never could a woman annul a silly vow of a husband or a son and be forgiven by the Lord. Never did a woman rescue her husband or her son from his silly words in the sight of the Lord. And I don't think it happens even today. The husbands are responsible for what they've said, no matter what the wife says. Honey, 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 no, 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 no. Don't you say that. Honey, honey, take that back. Oh, Tad, take it back. He's already said it. You cannot annul it, women. Men are responsible. Stringent it may seem, but women, you ought to like it. Because for women, what happens, it's protection of the highest order from the very lips of the Lord for you. And besides that, when I think of women and daughters, y'all are as pure as the driven snow and never sin one time. So please don't sin before you get home this afternoon. Lord Jesus, we thank you for this time to worship you and to study your word. In your name, amen and amen.